I want to start with a question of why one should care about the philosophy of mathematics at all, given, of course, that one cares about philosophy. It may seem as though philosophy of mathematics is just a branch of the philosophy of science and not even one of the most important branches, not as central as the philosophy of physics or philosophy of biology, for instance. But one good reason for paying attention to traditional views of the nature of mathematics is that such views have had a great impact on views on the nature of philosophy in general ever since Plato. And there are features of these views that have been quite tenacious. It seems to me that among the features of Plato's and Aristotle's philosophies that have survived into modern times, there are in particular the ones that depend on the exemplary status of mathematics for philosophy. The use of mathematics as an ideal for philosophy is a recurrent fact in the history of philosophy. I shall mention only a few examples. Most of the examples that Aristotle uses in his account of justified knowledge, episteme, in the prior analytics, are mathematical. Many of them are from geometry. And Descartes' paradigm examples of truths that can be grasped clearly and distinctly in mental intuition are mathematical. In his search for a general method for finding out the truth, in his early treatise, Rules for the Direction of the Mind, he starts out from arithmetic and geometry due to their superiority in certitude to other sciences, as he puts it. And he says that they deal with an object so pure and uncomplicated that they need make no assumptions at all, which experience renders uncertain. And Leibniz was quite serious about the idea of a universal characteristic, a universal calculus of reason in which it should be possible to determine the truth of any proposition by mere formal calculation. Leibniz's ideas were sources of inspiration for the logicism of Frege and Russell, which was an important part of the context where Wittgenstein began his philosophical work. You remember that the subtitle of Frege's Begriffsschrift is a formula language modeled upon that of arithmetic for pure thought. When philosophers have felt the need for having or making something pure, whether it is thought or reason or intuition, they have often used mathematics as exemplary. Maybe it was Plato who initiated this tendency. As another and more recent example of the use of mathematics as a model for philosophy, one could mention what Martin was talking about this morning, Quine and his idea of philosophical analysis as explication, and his use, for instance, of the mathematical notion of an ordered pair as a philosophical paradigm. A philosophical difficulty is said to be eliminated by means of a mathematical technique. However, what one can question here is whether this is really a use of mathematics as a model or an ideal for philosophy. If philosophy is taken to be a different discipline on a higher level than other sciences, it appears doubtful. It is rather a paradigm for philosophy as a branch of modern or contemporary science. The situation is similar for the proof theory or meta-mathematics of David Hilbert. Proof theory and the so-called Hilbert program in the foundations of mathematics was motivated by truly philosophical difficulties, the logical paradoxes, for instance. But proof theory is not a philosophical approach based upon mathematics merely as a methodological idea. Proof theory is literally mathematics. But this does not mean, it seems to me, that Quine and Hilbert and their followers succeeded in eliminating all philosophical and metaphysical claims through their trust in modern science. I'm inclined to agree with Nietzsche when he says that it is still a metaphysical phase upon which our faith in science rests. Scientific concepts, methods, and theories are the basis for drawing, at least implicitly, a boundary line between the true reality and mere appearance. And I have the feeling that Wittgenstein, I guess that Wittgenstein would have agreed with Nietzsche here too. So I think that this is a crucial point where I would say that Quine and Wittgenstein differs. In any case, the intimate relationship between philosophy and mathematics appears to have started already with Plato, or perhaps even with the Pythagoreans, if what they were doing was philosophy. What is translated as science in Plato's text is surely something very different from what we mean by the word, except perhaps that it seems for Plato, as well as in modern times, to have been a way of assigning a higher rank to a practice or a domain of knowledge to give it the status of a science. Elementary arithmetic and geometry were called sciences by Plato. And according to the received story, they were the sciences that are closest to the highest and most perfect sciences in Plato's hierarchy, dialectics, whose subject matter is the nonsensical and pure forms. The importance of mathematics for philosophy in Plato is not as applied mathematics, not very much at least. It is exemplary in something similar to an ethical or religious sense. Mathematics offers a path to the higher realities. There is a passage in Plato's Republic which reads, "Geometry is knowledge of what always is. It draws the soul towards truth and produces philosophical thought by directing upwards what we now wrongly direct downwards." In another passage it is said that the true philosopher, whose mind is directed towards the higher realities, looks unto the fixed and eternally immutable realm, where all is orderly and according to reason. And he imitates his realm and as much as possible assimilates himself to it. And by association with the divine order becomes himself orderly and divine as far as a human being can. So here is not just a question of acquiring useful techniques, concepts and methods, but rather the use of mathematics to accomplish a kind of self-transformation. In 1929, Wittgenstein makes the following remarks about mathematics. "There is no religious denomination in which so much sin has been committed through the misuse of metaphorical expressions as in mathematics. As an example of the misuse of metaphorical expressions that he might have had in mind here, consider drawing a circle on a paper using only a pencil, or on the blackboard only by means of a piece of chalk. And you know that it's not so easy. The circles will be better if you use a compass. And by further improving your tools for drawing circles, you will be able to produce more and more perfect circles. But, and here comes the tricky metaphor, you will never draw the absolutely perfect geometrical circle. It is an ideal, nonsensical object in another reality. The misuse of the metaphor consists in talking about the perfect or ideal circle as if it were literally a circle. This kind of misuse of metaphorical modes of expression appears to be essential for what has been called Platonism in the philosophy of mathematics, and it is still very common in contemporary philosophy of mathematics, for instance in certain influential views of transfinite set theory." I don't know why Wittgenstein compares mathematics to religion. He could have talked about mistakes or misconceptions rather than sin, and of metaphysical doctrines instead of religious denominations. It reminds me of a remark that Nietzsche makes about the origin of religion. He says, "The metaphysical need is not the origin of religions, as Schopenhauer supposed, but merely a late offshoot. Under the rule of religious ideas, one has become accustomed to the notion of another world, behind, below, above, and when religious ideas are destroyed, one is troubled by an uncomfortable emptiness and deprivation. From this feeling grows once again another world, but now merely a metaphysical one that is no longer religious. But what first led to the positing of another world, but now merely a metaphysical one that is not, what first led to the positing of another world in primeval times was not some impulse or need, but an error in the interpretation of certain natural events, a failure of the intellect." I don't know if the final point in this remark is only a polemic gesture against religion, or if he had some special historical circumstance in mind. Nietzsche was a classical philologist, so he might have thought about something specific. Anyhow, according to some historians, Greek religion in the centuries when philosophy first appeared was mainly belief in forces of nature of various kinds that demanded rites and sacrifices, but not so much more. But around the beginning of 500 before Christ, new forms of religions are said to appear that involved more. They were more sectarian religions with mystic ceremonies in which only specially initiated persons were allowed to participate. Another feature of this new form of religion was their dualistic thinking. Orphism, or the Orphic mysteries, was one such religion that is said to have strongly influenced early Greek philosophy, the Pythagoreans as well as Plato. The Orphic sectarian group led an Orphic life, practicing mystery cults, and the main goal was salvation of the soul from evil, with a view to a blessed existence after death in another world. Plato is said to have got many Orphic ideas from the Pythagoreans, who expressed the harmony between the harmony of the universe in terms of numerical relations, and possibly even claimed that things are numbers. And as to the relation between philosophy and mathematics, it has been said that early Greek history of mathematics is intimately joined together with the dualistic philosophy that had some of its roots in the religious mysteries. Well, what interests me about this story are two features. On the one hand, the dualistic way of thinking, which, among other things, tends to manifest itself in the idea that the subject matter of mathematics is outside mathematics. The objects that mathematics treats of belong to a self-standing realm external to mathematics as a human practice. Mathematics explores another and more perfect reality. The other feature is the philosophical sectarianism, according to which a philosopher is someone who has been initiated in the mysteries, and that gives him access to this higher reality. And knowledge of mathematics appears to be among these mysteries. It has struck me that it's possible to see, to some extent, secularized manifestations of these features throughout the history of philosophy and of mathematics, even in our own time. I've often met the attitude that one could perhaps describe by saying that to be a mathematician is to belong to the initiate. And then I'm not only thinking of the respectful and humble attitude towards mathematicians among people who do not know much mathematics but wish that they did. I'm also thinking of the kind of self-esteem that is common among mathematicians, among those who have to some extent assimilated themselves to the order that is characteristic of the disciplinary culture in mathematics. This order, however, is no longer taken to reflect a divine order, but rather contemporary ideals of intelligence. I think that there is a clear difference in this respect between mathematics and other sciences. I believe that this difference between physics and mathematics is connected with what Wittgenstein had in mind when he made the following remark. The best prepared these days for the study of philosophy are students of physics. Due to the evident lack of clarity in their science, their understanding is more loose than that of the mathematicians, who are stuck in their self-assured tradition. What is the nature of this self-assuredness among many mathematicians? Well, my suggestion is that it has a lot to do with the fact that having a natural talent for mathematics, as opposed to experience, ambition, capacity for hard work, etc., having a natural talent for mathematics is ranked higher among the criteria for being good in mathematics than the corresponding thing in other sciences. According to the standards cultivated within the tradition, good mathematicians are to some extent artists, like musicians. The most talented mathematicians tend to set the fashion for the aesthetics according to which one speaks about beautiful theorems, elegant proofs, important problems, and get great results. Seems to me that there is a similarity between the immediateness in which a talented mathematician and a good artist is working. It is as though the mathematician does not have to think, reflect, or reason very much, but can only put down what he's seeing immediately. This sort of capacity has been held as exemplary and has been protected in various ways, and it comes to expression in various features in the informal jargon of mathematics, in what one has agreed to take for granted, in what is considered to be well-known, obvious, self-evident, and trivial, as we have heard of in the talk. Well, I think that the notion of triviality that's common among mathematicians is something is trivial if it is of no consequence or interest and is known to everyone. But then usually everyone means everyone that is sufficiently initiated. But we can also get stuck in this self-assuredness, as Wittgenstein said, and become blind to problems and difficulties which are not mathematical. The idea that there should be intellectual problems and difficulties of any importance that concern mathematics itself, even on an elementary level, but which cannot be dealt with by means of mathematical constructions and inventions, is a thought that is almost impossible for the typical mathematician to swallow. It is as though his self-esteem is deeply hurt by that thought. I have quite a lot of experience of discussing philosophical issues with mathematicians, and their reaction has almost always been the same. If they think that you are serious with your question, you must be asking for a mathematical solution to the problem. So I think that there is a tradition, at least in modern times, but maybe ever since Plato, where one finds the attitude that by being initiated to the mysteries of mathematics, one has also acquired a sort of wisdom of a more general applicability, and in particular when it comes to philosophical issues. In the last part of Nietzsche's The Genealogy of Morals, where he expounds the meaning of the ascetic ideal, he proposes hubris as one important manifestation of the ascetic ideal in philosophers. It seems clear to me that the spirit of mathematics has had its part in shaping the philosophical hubris. It is a common feature of almost all the great figures in the discussion about the foundations of mathematics that started around the beginning of the 20th century, that their mathematical self-esteem made them think that they were qualified in acting as authorities, even on questions about how philosophical issues should be dealt with. These issues are really serious and difficult. They must be dealt with mathematically, because that's where we are experts on serious and difficult intellectual problems. This attitude is almost explicitly expressed by the mathematician David Hilbert, whose approach to the problems in the philosophy of mathematics has dominated the discussion in the 20th century. And Hilbert, unlike many of his followers, was very well aware that the problems that motivated his program were philosophical. Another great mathematician in the 20th century who has been taken as authority in philosophical matters on the basis of his great achievement as a mathematician is Kurt Gödel. And I think that this has been unfortunate for philosophy. I'm inclined to say that Gödel's influence on the philosophical discussion from the 30s marks a decline compared to the discussion that took place in the first two decades of the 20th century. As an example of Gödel's influence, I would like to mention the way in which he set the standard for the discussions of the so-called ontological issues in the philosophy of mathematics. That is, questions concerning the nature of the objects that mathematics is supposed to be about. As an example of Gödel's way of speaking about such issues, listen to this. We must count as abstract those concepts which are essentially of the second and higher order. By this we mean those concepts which do not comprise properties or relations of concrete objects, as for instance combinations of symbols. Classes and concepts may also be conceived as real objects, namely classes as pluralities of things, and concepts as properties and relations of things existing independently of our definitions and constructions. It seems to me that the assumption of such objects is quite as legitimate as the assumption of physical bodies. End of quote. I'm inclined to say that the distinction between concrete and abstract objects that is introduced here and has become a standard conception in contemporary philosophical jargon is highly problematic and very superficial. And it seems to me that this was something that struck Wittgenstein immediately. What should be noticed about Gödel's way of speaking here is that the underlying grammar for the concepts and distinctions that are introduced is a mathematical calculus, namely the predicate calculus of first and higher order. Or rather, it's not the predicate calculus as a calculus, but the calculus together with a reading or a translation of the formulas into ordinary verbal language. On the basis of this translation, the structure of the predicate calculus is taken to be the expression of the ultimate form of mathematical reality. And Gödel's dogmatic attitude reflects the ignorance towards all the worries and problems about the foundational significance of formal logic that were discussed in the first two decades of the 20th century with much more concern for conceptual difficulties. I think that Gödel, due to his authority as a mathematical genius, had an important role in creating the new intellectual climate that starts to develop within the discussion of the foundations of in the beginning of the 1930s, and in which there is a shift of interest from philosophical to mathematical issues. It was around this time that Wittgenstein said that philosophy has lost its nimbus. I don't know if he had this development of logic in mind, but he might have. He most certainly had this increasing dominance of mathematical logic in mind when he made the following remark. And I quote, "Mathematical logic has completely deformed the thinking of mathematicians and of philosophers by setting up a superficial interpretation of the forms of everyday language as an analysis of the structure of facts. Of course, in this it has only continued to build on the Aristotelian logic." End of quote. In what sense, then, has mathematical logic, according to Wittgenstein, resulted in a more superficial way of thinking? Well, he puts it as follows. "The curse of the invasion of mathematics by mathematical logic is that now any proposition can be represented in mathematical symbolism, and this makes us feel obliged to understand it. Although, of course, this method of writing is nothing but the translation of vague, ordinary proofs." End of quote. What about this makes us feel obliged to understand it? From where comes this feeling that the propositions have a clear and precise sense that we must understand and accept when they are translated into mathematical symbols? Why have so many intelligent persons been willing to swallow superficial notions and ideas when they are rendered in mathematical symbolism? Is it because the mathematical representations have the charm of messages that appear to come from those who are initiated in the mysteries? Or is it rather in our times due to the powerful tools that mathematical techniques have been in the creation of our technology and contemporary forms of life? Or maybe these two reasons are connected. Heidegger has said that Platonist metaphysics has reached its completion in contemporary science and technology. Or is there a better explanation? Well, I leave that question open. I want to say one more thing about the dualism between, on the one hand, the mathematical propositions, theorems, symbols, or geometrical figures that we write down and operate with on papers and blackboards. And that can be rubbed out and destroyed. And on the other hand, the mathematical objects that these propositions or theorems are supposed to treat of or be about, and that cannot be destroyed since they are said to be eternal and immutable abstract objects. Or in other words, the tendency to locate the real subject matter of mathematics outside mathematics as a human practice or activity, in another reality that has been described as an ideal reality that we can reach in thought by transgressing the limitations of sensible reality. What is the significance of the magical ring of these ways of describing what mathematics is about? Well, perhaps not as they are used in the vulgar jargon of academic philosophical commentary, but by the thinkers like Cantor and Gödel who really used them, or similar ones, to express their most urgent thoughts. It seems to me to be connected with the effort to or wish to justify a mathematical practice as a science, or as a legitimate part of the science of mathematics. An existing mathematical practice is raised to the rank of a science through the introduction of a formal order and unity in the practice. And the subject matter it treats of is a projection of the imposed order. For instance, the structure of mathematical reality that Gödel speaks of in the quotation I gave is obviously the result of a projection imposed by the apparatus of mathematical logic and metamathematics. But there is a further move in this process of raising a practice to the rank of a science. The subject matter of mathematics that is originally a projection of the imposed order is taken to be an independently existing reality. What is the nature of this move? Well, I think it's a change of attitude to the practice as a whole. The practice as an activity is given a secondary role, and the imposed order is the primary thing. I would suggest that this may have been what was called assimilating oneself to the order of a higher reality in the Plato's Republic. Seen from the outside, this assimilating oneself to a higher order is letting oneself be led into an all-absorbing dogmatic attitude to the imposed order. Being absorbed by this attitude, the order becomes transparent, and the result of the projection appears as being independently existing. And one gets absorbed, among other things, by giving in to tempting but misleading similarities in language. It's very tempting, for instance, to think that the absolutely perfect circle must be a circle. Yes, it must be more of a circle than all particular circles, as much of a circle as anything can be. But it is an image of ours, an idol. So maybe this transgression is comparable to committing a sin. As another example of the way in which many mathematicians tend to be stuck in their self-assured tradition, I would like to mention what Nietzsche talked about as lack of historical sense. This is a deficiency that Nietzsche primarily reproaches philosophers, but it seems to me to be one important respect in which the mathematical spirit, l'esprit géométrique, Pascal called it, has been exemplary for many philosophers in the tradition. Some degree of lack of historical sense can be found in other sciences than mathematics, even in the humanities. It is a clear feature of the genre of historiography that is called disciplinary history, where a scientist or researcher is writing history about the development of his own discipline, the discipline where he's at home and has his self-respect as a scientist. A problematic feature of many treatises in disciplinary history is that they are often written in a more or less conscious wish of strengthening the legitimacy and unity of their own science, and then frequently at the expense of unfair treatments of work of earlier times, and sometimes even with a lack of interest in work in the past that did not develop into something that is considered important and fruitful by the standards of contemporary science. Well, my contention is that this tendency of being unfair to the past is a much more striking and common feature in the disciplinary history of mathematics than in the historiography of other sciences. The striking thing is not that writers consciously try to promote the standards of contemporary mathematics, but on the contrary, that it is done unconsciously on the basis of one's immediate self-assuredness. I think that the notion of disciplinary culture is a useful notion here. To the disciplinary culture of contemporary mathematics belongs various forms of consensus or agreement in the practices of mathematics. For instance, in the emphasis on natural talent, I've already mentioned. Here is also agreement in what is taken to be self-evident, in what can be left out in a proof or a computation because it's considered to be well-known or trivial. In what is considered to be important results, in the attitude to receive picture of its past and its development, a picture that usually manifests a certain ideal about the unity of mathematics as a science. Part of the disciplinary culture is also its language and idioms, practices of using signs and symbols, and not only the technical symbolism, but also the more or less informal jargon in which mathematicians communicate and in the way papers are written. There are many features of the informal language of mathematics that you can get access to only from within by learning to participate and become at home in the practices. The normal thing for a scientist is to have an immediate attitude to various features of the disciplinary culture he or she belongs to. And I think that this is particularly characteristic of mathematicians. It is as though it were a feature of the essence of the disciplinary culture of mathematics that it does not want to become aware of itself, in this historical sense at least. It is as though this awareness is threatening the control over his discipline that the mathematician wants to feel that he has. If a mathematician should engage in self-reflection and would be successful in getting some characteristic feature of his scientific practice into his field of sight, he immediately tends to transform it into mathematics. He sets about to do new mathematics out of it. Well, what I've said here is not true of all mathematicians. There are exceptions, but I believe that there are still exceptions to a clear unhistorical tendency that has prevailed in traditional mathematics. And it seems to me that it is connected with the old idea that mathematics explores an eternal and immutable subject matter. But maybe the situation is changing in our times. There is an increasing interest in the history of mathematics today, and a lot of research in the history of mathematics is done in a more serious effort to be fair to mathematical work of the past. It is not often noticed that philosophy of mathematics has almost always been philosophy of the science of mathematics, as though it could not be anything else. The aspect of mathematics as a body of truth or a body of knowledge about a certain subject matter has been emphasized, and the aspect of mathematics as a human activity comprising various techniques for calculation, proof, and construction is kept back. I was surprised to find a passage in Plato's Republic that gives a very explicit expression of contempt towards geometry as a practice, as opposed to geometry as a science. In this passage, it's first laid down that geometry as a science compels the soul to study true being, as opposed to becoming. And then it is said, "No one with even a little experience of geometry will dispute that this science is entirely the opposite of what is said about it in the accounts of its practitioners. They give ridiculous accounts of it, though they can't help it, for they speak like practical men, and all their accounts refer to doing things. They talk of squaring, applying, adding, and the like, whereas the entire subject is pursued for the sake of knowledge. End of quote. The aspect of mathematics as a practice is of primary interest in Wittgenstein's investigations, which is one reason why Wittgenstein's writings on the philosophy of mathematics appears to be a topic that is least understood and most ignored. Of his philosophical writings in general. One could say, in a sense, that Wittgenstein has a non-scientific conception of mathematics, or at least that is, this is the aspect of mathematics that he's most interested in. He is sometimes concerned about more advanced mathematical topics, but then mainly in what mathematicians are doing, not so much in what they think that they are doing. Wittgenstein was not an historical thinker in the style of Nietzsche, Spengler, and Heidegger. He does usually not make his points by making historical connections. The reference to Aristotle in the quotation I read earlier is one of a few exceptions. But I'm inclined to say that he was very much of an historical thinker, and he was very much ahead of his times as concerns his awareness of the present situation as regards mathematics. This is also one important reason why his remarks on the philosophy of mathematics have been difficult to understand. One might even say that getting clear about the present situation as regards mathematics is the main aim of Wittgenstein's investigations in the philosophy of mathematics. This is something that he states explicitly in various forms. For instance, as follows: our task is not to discover calculus, but to describe the present situation. And the word present is in italics. He also says in the remarks on the foundations of mathematics, it is not that a new bridge has to be erected, but that the geography, as it now is, has to be described. And he finishes that paragraph by saying, even 500 years ago, a philosophy of mathematics was possible, a philosophy of what mathematics was then. The motive of the foundational programs around the beginning of the 20th century was not only the epistemological one of securing the certainty of mathematical truths that had been imperiled by the discovery of the logical paradoxes. An important part of the motives was also to maintain the traditional ideal of mathematics as a science. And this motive became important in a historical situation when the rapid development of mathematical practice in various directions was threatening the unity of mathematics as a science. The Aristotelian idea of mathematics as a science of number and quantity was not compatible with the extensive change and development of mathematical practice that took place in the 19th century. A new account of the unity of pure mathematics was needed, one that neither the Aristotelian nor the Kantian philosophical traditions could offer. The foundational ideas of Frege, Dedekind, Russell, Hilbert, Poincaré, Brouwer, and others all express a kind of responsibility for securing the unity of mathematics as a science. And they all take this task to be in the borderland between philosophy and mathematics. But it seems to me that they belong to the last generation of great mathematicians in that respect. That these foundational ambitions had become obsolete and belong to the past is, it seems to me, something that Wittgenstein knew already in the beginning of the 30s. And since everything in his remarks on the foundations of mathematics is written in that awareness, it is clear that the remarks are difficult to understand for those who still believe in the possibility of realizing the foundational aims or modifications of them. And that includes most logicians and philosophers of mathematics since the Surtees. So this is one important sense in which I think that Wittgenstein was ahead of his times. He was more clear about the present situation in mathematics than most of his contemporaries. The enormous development of mathematics into specialties that in their turn has split up into new specialties during the 20th century makes it even doubtful if one can say that mathematics today is a science in the traditional sense. The academic discipline of mathematics today is rather a vast field of specialties and research areas that are more or less related to one another. And it's not at all clear how the question about the unity of contemporary mathematics should be answered, except perhaps by saying that all specialties have their foundation in elementary mathematics, which is, as I already said, where the main interest in Wittgenstein's investigations lies. Thank you.